number 26995, Carlisle versus One Vote. Arguing for the petitioners, Brian Monfly Cole. Arguing for the respondent, Charlotte J. Moore. Argument on the merits.
Morning, counsel.
Morning, Your Honor. Brian Cole for appellant, any kind of sanction.
Please proceed.
Your Honor, I've reserved 5 minutes of rebuttal, just so you're aware. On behalf of my clients, thank you for granting appellee's writ of certiorari. By way of background, this case arises out of appellant's frivolous attempt to, one, charge appellee Dang Tran, an immigrant fisherman, in a criminal proceeding with intentionally taking live rock and live coral with his fishing net, in violation of Administrative Rules 139570 and 139571, and two, pursuing a separate civil forfeiture action against his boat, fishing gear, and other property in connection with the alleged violations. Mr. Tran prevailed in the criminal proceeding. The trial judge in that case had no trouble recognizing the absurdity of appellee's argument that on the night in question, Mr. Tran did not intend to use his fishing net to catch rock and coral. And although he prevailed in the criminal proceeding, appellant decided to press forward with the civil forfeiture action, which gave appellant a second bite at the apple and the power to take away Mr. Tran's boat, fishing gear, which was his sole means of earning a livelihood, for alleged violations that he had already been vindicated of in the criminal case under circumstances where the appellant's burden of proof was lower. In the civil forfeiture case, it's a preponderance of the evidence, as opposed to in the criminal case, it's beyond a reasonable doubt. Prior to trial, Mr. Tran filed a motion to dismiss, which was granted by the Honorable Rinaldo Gualti. A written order granting that motion was filed on February 1, 2002, and thereafter, for a period of 2 years and 9 months, appellant took no action, and there was no activity in the case. There was no communication between the parties in that entire time period, in which appellant specifically said, you know, it was their intent or that they had any desire to pursue an appeal in this case. The case sat dead and dormant. I come before you this morning on behalf of my clients to request that you A, vacate the Intermediate Court of Appeals opinion in this case filed on February 27, 2008, and dismiss this appeal for lack of appellate jurisdiction, or two, affirm Judge Gualti's order granting appellee's motion to dismiss. On the issue of jurisdiction, with all due respect to this court, I believe that appellate jurisdiction is lacking because there was a complete failure to file a timely notice of appeal. The deadline for appellant to file their notice was March 4, 2002. Rule 4, Hawaii Rules of Appellate Procedure, mandates that a notice must be filed within 30 days after the entry of a judgment or appealable order, or unless an extension is otherwise granted as allowed under the rules. There's no dispute that the 30-day period passed, that there was no request or effort or to obtain an extension, nor was one granted. And similarly, there's no evidence in the record that a timely notice was filed. And so, you know, once that 30-day window passed, the time for filing a notice of appeal expired.
Mr. Ho, how do you get around the Jenkins rule requiring a separate judgment filed?
Very simply, Your Honor. The Intermediate Court of Appeals interpreted Jenkins to say that the 30-day window for filing a notice doesn't start running until a judgment is filed. The court, my interpretation of what the court held in Jenkins was simply, we're overburdened, we're tired of having to sift through cases only to find that it's not right for appeal, whether that was an error on the lower court or any of the parties or their attorneys. So what the court did was throw that burden back down to the parties responsible and said, you cannot come forward unless you have a judgment. And so the way I interpret Jenkins is the court said having a judgment on filed is a prerequisite to going forward with an appeal. But it doesn't, the court did not go so far as to state that the filing of the judgment is what starts the running of the 30-day period, or the absence of filing a judgment tolls the starting.
So your construction of the Jenkins rule is that a separate judgment does not trigger the running of the 30-day period, but rather that at some time within the 30-day period triggered by something else, a separate judgment must be filed?
No, Your Honor, not quite exactly. What I'm saying is you don't need a separate judgment to start the 30-day period. If you have a final dispositive order that clearly dismisses all claims against all parties, as we had in this case, and a party takes no action, in this case for 2 years and 9 months, to preserve their appellate rights, then I think the rules of civil procedure say, you know, you had 30 days. And if you take no action, you've waived that right, basically. And all Jenkins does is say, if you want to pursue an appeal, if you're going to pursue an appeal, you need to make sure you have a judgment on file with the state court first. And if you don't have that, then we're going to dismiss your appeal. But Jenkins doesn't address the issue of waiver, which is what I think the appellant has done in this case, is they had an appealable, the final order, which clearly dismissed everything, and then sat on their hands and took no action of any kind for a very substantial period of time. And so,
Mr. Ho, did you argue waiver?
I did, Your Honor. I believe I did.
What was your argument on waiver?
That they basically waited 2 years and 9 months and took no action of any kind to perfect their appeal.
You set out the test for waiver and applied it. You set out a test for waiver and applied it in your brief?
I would have to say I did not cite any case law or legal authority, but I did argue it. I did argue it. Does that address your question, Your Honor?
As far as I guess you can. The rule provides that there has to be a judgment or appealable order. There was no judgment. Was this order entered by, I'm not sure who entered it, Judge Guralty, an appealable order?
Yes, because it was final and dispositive as to all claims between all parties.
You argued that?
Yes, I did, Your Honor.
Whose obligation was it to see that a judgment was filed?
The ICA said that it was my responsibility. But as I've cited in the briefs, my interpretation of Rule 23, the ICA said it was my responsibility under Rule 23, Hawaii Rules of Circuit Court. I interpret Hawaii Rule 23 to set forth the procedures for settling the form of orders when there's a dispute as to its form and content. I cited in my brief Rule 58 as the controlling authority as far as who had responsibility for preparing a judgment in this case. And under the facts and circumstances of this particular case, Judge Guralty instructed my firm to prepare an order regarding the motion, which we did. He did not instruct anybody as far as who was responsible for preparing a separate judgment. And under Rule 58, Hawaii Rules of Civil Procedure, in pertinent part, it says, when the court directs that all relief be denied, the clerk shall enter a judgment forthwith upon receipt by him of the direction. So I think under Rule 58, Judge Guralty was supposed to issue an order to the court to enter a separate judgment. And I think that's pretty clear. And I'm not trying to skirt responsibility, but truthfully, that was my state of mind on how things would proceed. I was instructed to prepare the order, which my firm did. And then I correlate this situation, Your Honors, to a situation where a civil case is dismissed on the circuit court's own volition because a party has not prosecuted their case. As you know, under Rule 12, the court can dismiss a case that's not being prosecuted in a timely manner. I've never seen a situation where a judgment is filed in that case. So if a plaintiff whose case is dismissed by order of the court unilaterally waits for 2 years, 5 years, 10 years, 100 years, and then decides to pursue an appeal because no judgment is filed, will that appeal be timely? This is a slippery slope that we don't want to encourage parties or attorneys to take advantage of. Again, 2 years and 9 months is a long time to do nothing. As far as the forfeiture itself, I think that can be boiled down to its simplest elements by saying this statute, as interpreted by the appellant, violates the appellee's due process, rights to due process under the law, because the statute does not specifically provide for forfeiture as a penalty in this case. And the brief set forth our analysis, which is, if you're going to forfeit somebody's property, particularly in a case like this where they've already been vindicated in the criminal proceeding, you have to give them reasonable notice that forfeiture is a possible consequence of their alleged criminal or unlawful activity. That is not set forth in the administrative rules, which Mr. Tran was charged with violating. It's not set forth in HRS Chapter 712A, which is the forfeiture statute. Instead, what appellant argues is there's a third provision, which is Hawaii Revised Statute Chapter 199, which supposedly provides for forfeiture as a penalty. But when you look at that statute carefully, it really does nothing more than set forth the police powers of the DLNR DoCare officers in conducting their duties. And I think that the ICA, which interpreted that statute to be a basis for forfeiture, is violative of the appellee's due process rights, because when somebody is fishing, as in this case, they look at the administrative rules to determine what conduct is lawful and unlawful. They also look at what the potential penalties of unlawful conduct is. When you do the research on that admin rule, it refers to it. You can easily refer to the forfeiture statute under Chapter 712. So you can then do more reading and further educate yourself as far as what the rights and potential consequences of your actions are. And similarly, you can also, your research would take you to Chapter 187 of the Hawaii Revised Statute, which sets forth the actual penalties that could arise if you're found in violation of these two specific administrative rules, both in a criminal context as well as civil administrative fines or civil penalties that could issue. That's what Chapter 187 Hawaii Revised Statute sets forth. So, yes.
Version of 199.7, which has been amended over the years several times, is the 1999 version that's applicable to this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the prior 199.7 does not fit the ICA's analysis of blanket forfeiture of Title 12 violations. Is that correct? It's only the amendment that came in 1999 that the ICA indicated provided for this blanket coverage.
I'm going to have to admit, Your Honor, that I cannot speak to that particular question. I apologize.
Okay, the 1999 amendment primarily dealt with natural resources.
Right.
Okay, is that what the ICA is sort of
hanging their head on?
Upon?
It's my impression, Your Honor.
So the prior 1997s throughout the years did not comport or do not comport with the ICA's analysis?
I believe that's correct.
And what in that analysis are you disputing?
it's a difference of interpretation as far as the purpose and intent, or the purpose and intent of 199-7. And again, I said that that statute does nothing more than delineate the scope of the police powers. Well, it verifies, one, the police powers of the Doe Care officers, and then it sets forth the parameters of their authority, which includes being able to seize property. And it doesn't go beyond that, and it doesn't authorize forfeiture in specific cases in order to determine whether or not any particular set of facts or circumstances property is subject to forfeiture. You have to look to other specific statutes that deal with that particular situation. And so the cases we've cited would be like the cable TV, the theft of the cable TV, hunting violations, in which within the parameters of those specific statutes and those particular admin rules, the penalty of forfeiture is specifically articulated within those laws.
So your argument is that reading 199-7 does not give your client notice that his property was subject to forfeiture.
That's correct, Your Honor. There's two parts to the argument that we are making to the court today. One is, when you read the admin rules that he was charged with violating, when you read Chapter 187 HRS, which sets forth the specific penalties both for the criminal proceeding and a subsequent civil penalty or civil forfeiture proceeding, as well as HRS 712, which is the law that sets forth when forfeiture is allowed and how it happens, none of those statutes or rules give you an inkling or an idea that you need to also go look at Chapter 199 of the HRS. That's my first point. So if you don't have reasonable notice or a reasonable means to realize that that's a potential consequence, you know, the law is unconstitutional for denying my client due process. And then the second argument would be that it doesn't provide for forfeiture. It simply delineates the police powers given to the Doe Care officers.
And with respect to Chapter 712A,
yes,
I take it that you're relying particularly on 712A4 subsection A, none of the other subsections of 712A4 applying to the offense in this case.
Exactly, Your Honor. And the problem with this particular case and the ICA's interpretation of 199 as it applies to this case, it's almost a bootstrapping, because how can you generally authorize forfeiture, which is pursuant to Chapter 712A, and then 712A says, but forfeiture is only allowed under these specific circumstances. So it's a circuitous argument in my mind, because you know, you can say something is subject to forfeiture, but it's subject to 712A, and then you go to 712A and you look at, you know, subpart 4, and you look at those examples, and you say, well, none of them apply to me. I don't know.
You refer to the wildlife section of Title 12.
Yes.
Are you indicating that there are provisions which, if violated, specifically refer to the language specifically authorizing forfeiture?
Let me see if this answers your question. There's nothing in the admin rules under Part 12 that applies to fishing that specifically authorizes forfeiture as a penalty. It talks about it being a petty misdemeanor and other language like that. By way of analogy, in support of our argument, we cited to other statutes, the hunting, the theft of the cable TV, in which those specific provisions specifically said forfeiture is a possible consequence of violating these provisions. And so
that's in Title 12?
I don't believe under Title 12, Your Honor.
The hunting violation that you're referring to is what section? What section are you referring to?
Give me one second, please.
Okay, 183D5.
Thank you. Thank you, Your Honor. Appreciate your assistance.
Okay, that refers to if you're convicted of third offense.
Right.
And then it specifically indicates shall be, the equipment shall be considered contraband to be forfeited to and disposed of by the state.
Right.
Are there any other provisions in, and that's in Title 12?
Oh, my apologies. Okay.
So are you knowledgeable as to any other provisions which specifically refers to forfeiture?
Not under Title 12. Not under Title 12, Your Honor. If I had been, I would have cited to them. But I did cite Chapter 708 for the cable television example. I think under the...
What about regulations? Are there any regulations that specifically refer to forfeiture?
Not as far as Title 12 or the DLNR. The admin rules are their form of regulations, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any other independent regulations other than the admin rules or the Hawaii Revised Statutes. Thank you. That's pretty much my presentation. Unless you have any further questions, I'll save the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
If it please the Court, Charlotte Duarte, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney, on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Two issues presented, one, appellate jurisdiction, and two, 199-7. The record says as it says. It is as it is. Reference to petitioners being vindicated in the criminal proceeding, I'm sorry, I cannot find that in the record on appeal. Also, as was represented by the state to Judge Waldorf during the December 24th, 04 hearing, the defendant property was returned already to the petitioners. Because of the nature of the protracted nature of the litigation, the state felt that it was in its best interest to, and it was fairest, to return the property after Judge Gralty's order was issued. I'm sorry, the actual date of return is not in the record, but it was prior to Judge Waldorf's hearing, certainly. Because the state still had other remedies under 712A to proceed without causing damage to the property and affecting its value. So in an abundance of caution and in retrospect, it was the right thing to do. The property was returned to the petitioners. As far as the notice of appeal, the state relied upon Jenkins. Jenkins is not waivable. It's strictly enforced. And it requires, when you read Jenkins with Rules of Civil Procedure 58 and the Circuit Court Rules of 23, it requires the prevailing party to reduce an order, including an order to dismiss, to a judgment in a separate document. This became even more important because, as petitioner acknowledged to Judge Waldorf, Judge Gralty's order was not final because it did not involve one of the issues that still remained hanging out there, fees and cost, and that would be transcript 12-2704, page 4, lines 6 to 11. So,
how long was prosecution willing to wait for the petitioner to file a judgment?
Honestly, I think Judge Waldorf said it best. It fell through the cracks. It wasn't a matter of waiting. It fell through the cracks. And as represented to Judge Waldorf, it was not, the state did not realize that it had done that until the state got sued and the lack of appeal was used as a basis for the lawsuit. There was some discussion about the lawsuit before Judge Waldorf, then realized that perhaps, and that was the allegation made, perhaps that was why the prevailing party delayed in filing the judgment. But Judge Waldorf, I think, did it right. She said that rather than find nefarious conduct on the part of any party, it fell through everyone's cracks. Petitioners, the state, even Judge Gralty's. So once the error was found, the state took action.
You argue, though, that it's not waivable.
It isn't waivable, yes. So it doesn't...
I don't think this would ever happen, but petitioner argued, well, then 100 years is still enough time within which to file a judgment. Are there any limits on how long a judgment can remain outstanding and still be the basis for an appeal?
Not within the rules, Your Honor. However, the state's of the position that this is not the vehicle for penalizing a non-prevailing party for not doing something they had no obligation to do.
Well,
but I understand the court's concern.
If you know you want to appeal a case and a judgment hasn't been entered, conceivably, you could enter the judgment yourself. I think I've seen that in cases.
And that's what the state ended up doing in this case, too.
Yeah, 2 years and so many days later.
Correct.
But, or you could just bring a motion to the court.
Correct.
Right?
And that
move the court to have a judgment filed. Why wasn't that done?
It fell through the cracks. That's all I can explain. That's all I can say at this point. I wish I had a better explanation. The state has gone through the record and tried to figure out what went wrong, and that's all that the state can say. It just fell out of the state's counsel's consciousness until such time as the lawsuit came in. Oh my gosh, the judgment wasn't filed. That's why. And as soon as that happened, the judgment was filed, the case was the state got the case back on track. Fortunately, and I think part of the reason was because the property had already been returned. So it fell out of our consciousness. But the appeal became necessary and the state brought the case back on track to the best of its ability. As far as...
What do you mean the appeal became necessary? The state didn't have the intent to appeal at the time Judge Guaraldi entered his order?
The state did, but...
Why did it become necessary at a later time?
It was a reminder that the judgment had not been filed. When the lawsuit was served on us, on the state, a year after, I think that is in the record, I hope it is, a year after it had been filed, and the language, the basis of the lawsuit was that the state had waived its appeal. That's when counsel for the state realized that counsel had messed up and had intended to appeal it, and the case just lost its place in line. And as soon as that happened, the state realized it had failed to do what it needed to do, attempted to get the judgment filed, or encouraged the judgment to be filed, and when that did not happen, the state took action and had Judge Waldorf prepare the judgment, and had Judge Waldorf enter the judgment. That's the best the state can do. I know that's not enough, but excusable neglect. Nonetheless, Jenkins is as it is. The filing of the notice of appeal at that point did not prejudice the petitioners insofar as the petitioners had the property back. The state took a gamble because the state, should the state prevail, can still return on the forfeiture but seek alternative substitute assets under 712A. Should the state prevail here, 712A permits that remedy. So the case is not moot with the return of the property, but it mitigates the damages that might have been experienced by petitioners because the petitioners got their property back.
What going to the merits, what is the significance of Section 199.7B in the context of your argument that the property was subject to forfeiture? Or what on what language are you relying?
I want to give you the exact language under subsection B. Any equipment, article, instrument, aircraft, vessel, vehicle, business record, or natural resource seized is subject to forfeiture pursuant to Chapter 712A. But 199.7 must be read in its entirety. If I can reverse back, the Hawaii Administrative Rules 1395, 70, and 71 establish petty offenses that are establish offenses that are petty misdemeanor offenses and have the force and effect of law under Title 12. 712A1 defines a covered offense as offenses for which forfeiture is provided by law relating to a particular offense. Also under Title 12, 199.7 is such a law relating to offenses under Title 12, including the Hawaii Administrative Rules 1395, 70, and 71. 199.7A provides for property that can be seized. 199.7B provides that property that can be seized can also be subject to 712A forfeiture. In reference to 183...
Forfeiture pursuant to Chapter
712A.
Meaning that some language in Chapter 712A has to authorize the forfeiture.
Then that would be 712A 4A that allows for any statute that specifically authorizes forfeiture, and we the state's position is that 199.7 does that. First of all, 183.5, in answer to Justice Moon's question, 183.5 provides for summary forfeiture
if,
of contraband. It provides for summary forfeiture, but not of contraband. Summary forfeiture of contraband is always permissible, but that is not pursuant to the due
not
process.
This particular section that you're looking at, 183.5, specifically indicates
712
subject to forfeiture. Why do you say it always does, unless it specifically indicates it's not subject to forfeiture, right?
No.
Under 183.5,
it's not 712A forfeiture.
I'm sorry?
It's not 712A forfeiture, because under 183A5, the property in question becomes contraband, and contraband is always subject to summary forfeiture. I guess procedurally, what would happen is at sentencing, or even upon conviction, the state at the criminal case could then stand up and say, with that conviction, these items are now contraband and we request that they be forfeited to the state. Without all of the due process requirements required under 712A. However, under 199.7, the kind of forfeiture they're looking at is the 712A forfeiture, the civil in rem procedures with all the due process protections in place. And so because the vessel in question, the property in question, even with conviction, would not be contraband. So he has a right to respond, for example, and all the due process rights under that. Now,
what was the offense of which the petitioners were charged that specifically authorizes forfeiture within the meaning of 712A4A.
Again, the HAR rules are promulgated under Title 12. Title 12 also provides for the remedy, the criminal penalties for HAR violations in 187A5. As well as other remedies under 199-7. So the fact that the 199-7 remedy is not included as a criminal penalty is appropriate under State v. Tuipulopua, since forfeiture is a separate remedy and not part of the criminal penalty. So the Hawaii administrative rules are promulgated under Title 12, and Title 12 also provides not only the criminal penalties for those rule violations, but other remedies that may be pursued by the state.
Well, if 199.7b means what you argue that it means,
mm-hmm.
then isn't 712A4A surplusage?
712A4A becomes, maybe it's a really unique situation that we have here, because we don't have covered offenses by in administrative rules for anything else. This is very unique. But 712A4 becomes important for those offenses that that refer to forfeiture penalties in the criminal statute itself.
There are no HAR provisions which call for forfeiture.
That's right. Within the HAR, there's no reference to 712A forfeiture within the HAR. That's correct.
HAR 13-122-12 rules regulating game, bird hunting, field trials, and commercial shooting preserves. When you look at that, it indicates that persons found to be in violation of any provision of this chapter, and they're talking about this HR rule. Any equipment, articles, instrument, aircraft, vehicles, and so forth may be seized and subject to forfeiture. That's an HAR rule. I mean, that's in the HAR.
Yes, it is. I was not aware of that. I'm sorry. I was not aware of it.
You have specifically referenced to the language that 712A 4A provides here in the rules and also in the statute. And so as Justice Levinson asked, is it just superfluous, that language 712-4A?
Is it unnecessary? Well, no, because 712A4 provides for all those circumstances where that chapter can be applied, so it does have to have a cross-reference.
Isn't it in effect your argument that all offenses to which 199.7 speaks specifically authorize forfeiture?
Correct.
Well, then why do we need a 712A4A?
We need it for all those other circumstances where we have other statutes that are not applicable.
I'm not talking about B, C, and D.
No, I'm talking about A. For example, 134.26 is when you transport a loaded firearm in a vehicle, there is a separate 712A forfeiture provision in that statute that's not included in B or C of 712A4. So it falls under 712A4A. And frequently the legislature will do that. They will, animals removed from quarantine prematurely can be forfeited, 441 something. It's included in that statute, but it's not listed as one of the offenses under B or C. So 4A, since 712A is a statute of general applicability, that language becomes important. Perhaps it's overkill in the case of the HAR rules and 199-7, but err on the side of caution. That should not be a basis to find that 199-7 did not provide notice to petitioners, and in fact, petitioners had actual notice that they would be subject to forfeiture. That would be in the Record on Appeal, Volume 1, pages 11 and 12, that discuss how a year earlier, petitioners had been subject to 712A forfeiture and citing for exactly the same rule violations, and the property seized was exactly the same boat and trailer. So if you're looking at whether they received actual notice, they received actual notice. Whether or not 199-7 provides such notice, it does.
Is it unambiguous? You you agree with the IC's language that concluded HRS 1997 unambiguously provides that the property used in violation of Title 12 and rules adopted thereunder is subject to seizure and forfeiture? Is it unambiguous?
The state is of the position that it is. I understand that there are arguments to the contrary, but it is...
In a person reading 1997 that took some coral, mistakenly, supposedly, understands that his boat engine and equipment will be forfeited by reading 199-7. Do you really believe that? When a section in the rules, HR rules, indicate this is a petty misdemeanor, $100 for the first offense, you know? I mean, is that your position, that you read 199-7 and it is unambiguous that my property is going to be seized and forfeited?
It has been unambiguous as the state's position.
Well,
obviously, then, the state is wrong, but...
If you don't mind, should we take a moment to probe Mr. Ho's circularity argument? As I hear him, his argument is, in effect, this. Here's what the state's arguing. The state's arguing that 199.7b authorizes the forfeiture of equipment that is subject to forfeiture pursuant to 712A. So you look to 712A to determine whether any given equipment is subject to forfeiture. And 712A4A says all offenses which specifically authorize forfeiture. Well, how do you know if you're dealing with an offense that specifically authorizes forfeiture? Well, you go back to 199.7. And so aren't you just going in an endless circle chasing your tail?
But there's 712A1, which covers, defines what a covered offense is. And it's clear that 199.7 is applicable. So you read the statute in its totality. In addition, there is some question that it's 199.7 language is surplusage because it just authorizes forfeiture, gives them the police power. They have that police power, both in 712A in the definition of law enforcement officers and in 199-4A giving them the authority of police officers. So it's not surplusage. And when viewed in light of the entire legislative history, this statute was originally amended to include 712A in 1989. In 1988, the 712A forfeiture statute became, the sunset provision was eliminated and it became fixed within the HRS. In 1989 was the first time 199.7 was amended to include reference to it. It's been amended in other ways since then. But prior to that, 199.7 referred to forfeiture, but that kind of forfeiture was in Chapter 701 and did not provide for the kind of due process that the state believed was necessary and is incorporated in 712A. So the 712A forfeiture has been law and within 199-7 since 1989 and has... And as such, when you look at, and then, of course, the legislative history of the statute is replete with the legislature's intent to include forfeiture and allow for forfeiture in addition to other remedies to enable DOCARE, Department of Land and Natural Resources, Division of Conservation and Resource Enforcement Officers, DOCARE officers, to do their job, and that is protect the environment. And while it is true that these offenses are petty misdemeanors, the wisdom of that we have to leave to the legislature, notwithstanding the damage this can cause, you know, to the environment. However, we too have 712A5.5 that precludes excessive forfeitures. That is, the trial court can determine, based on the nature and the severity of the offense and the damage caused, they can determine whether the item that is the state seeks to forfeit should be returned in whole or in part, or do other some other kind of justice. 712A5.5?
Excessive, yeah.
No. No, because we didn't get to the merits of the forfeiture petition. That would be handled by the trial court after hearing the evidence supporting forfeiture. We didn't even get that far. We haven't even got that far. We're now dealing with whether or not we can even get past a motion to dismiss. And that's where the case stopped.
It was raised by Mr. Tran, wasn't it? Excessive fines.
I think he raised the petitioner raised it in its argument, but because see it
prevailed below, you didn't have to get into it.
Well, yes, that's something that the trial court would decide in determining one, that the verified petition for forfeiture will be granted, and two, if granted, what should be the remedy. And we didn't get that far. We're still discussing whether or not there's a dismissal. If that's the court's concern, however, 5.5 was also included, I believe, in right after Tui Pua Pua, that would have been around 1996. That provision was included. I think that's when it was. I'm sorry if I misspeak. Following usury in those cases, the U.S. Supreme Court cases concerning excessiveness and double jeopardy and all of that. So our legislature, although later it was determined that it was not a necessary provision, it's in there and we live with it, and the state is satisfied with it. Even if it's not required by the U.S. Supreme Court, we think it's a fair provision. And it was our provision that we submitted to the legislature. So it's there. The protections are there should we get to the verified petition for forfeiture. In this case, because we would be looking for substitute assets, it becomes even easier for the court. It doesn't have to split the boat, so to speak. The court would only need to say, look, this case is only worth $100 state, so even if you win, you get $100. So be it. We'll live with that. But nonetheless, yes.
Ms. Gordon.
Yes.
I think you referred to other statutes, the provisions which indicate specifically violation calls for forfeiture.
Yes.
There are other statutes outside of Title 12.
Yes.
And they refer
or outside of Title...
outside of Title 12, other statutes regarding
yes.
forfeiture of vehicle and operating the vehicle on a public highway carrying a loaded firearm.
Correct.
And repeated racing.
Yes.
Right? You can
yes.
forfeit the vehicle and
right.
so forth. They're all specifically referred to 712A.
Correct, and they're all included in the HRS.
Yeah.
This is the only case where it's an administrative rule as opposed to something specific, a specific section of the HRS that right. defines the offense.
Yes, I'm sorry, Ms. Lloyd.
No, I'm sorry, I apologize.
You admit now that there are rules, at least we look at one rule, that specifically indicates forfeiture.
Yes, I now am aware that the rules do indicate forfeiture.
And you believe that it's something that is not superfluous?
No. There
is a reason for it.
There's a method to the madness, yes, Your Honor.
But you don't think it's the reason is because of 712A4A?
I don't think that 712A4A is superfluous in this case. I think it's necessary. And it says, what it basically does is any other law that includes 712A, you got to follow these procedures. I think, in effect, that's what it does.
Hypothetically, if there were no 712A4A, I mean, if 712A4 began with what is now B, but were numbered A,
mm-hmm.
Would you still be arguing entitlement to forfeiture?
No. No. Because 712A4A says, 712A4 says, these are the offenses for which forfeiture can be granted. This is it. Nothing more. This is it.
The ones that specifically authorize forfeiture.
A, B, and C, yes. And so if we didn't have A, we'd have just B and C. And all those other statutes out there that include reference to 712A.
But you're arguing that 199.7 specifically authorizes forfeiture.
Yes, as does 134-26.
Well, if 199.7 specifically authorizes forfeiture, why wouldn't that be sufficient for your purposes?
because we need 712A4A to bring that section, that provision of the HRS, within the parameters of 712A. And remember, 712A provides, from start to finish, a very organized way in which forfeiture has to proceed. And it provides all the due process that's required. If we... Yeah, I guess so. If we have, with 4A, we now have it essential or imposed upon the state to follow all the provisions of 712A, even in cases where the where the criminal offense is not included in B and C, but refers to 712A in itself. It's a way in which, to make it extremely clear, that the forfeiture process under 712A must apply.
Is it a fair implication of 712A4A that some offenses, whatever they may be, do not specifically authorize forfeiture?
Is that a fair inference?
Yeah.
No,
if
because...
If it provides for forfeiture with respect to all offenses that do specifically authorize forfeiture, isn't it implicit that there must be some offenses that do not specifically authorize forfeiture?
I understand the question. Yes. For example, 183A5 does not authorize 712A forfeiture and the due process that comes with it. It authorizes the summary forfeiture of contraband. As such, the state doesn't have to follow 712A. And that's the protection. It's perhaps a check and a double check on the state's power, which is not a bad thing. If the court has no further questions for me, then the state will rest on its briefs as well and the ICA opinion. Thank you very much.
Mr. Holmes.
Very, very briefly, Your Honor.
Very interesting debate. Thank you for taking the time and being so well-informed. In my mind, it can be boiled down to this. The two administrative rules that my client was charged with violating, the penalty provisions that set forth the consequence of violating these administrative rules, are set forth specifically in HRS Chapter 187A. That chapter does not say your property is subject to forfeiture. It says there's criminal penalties, and here's what they are. It's a petty misdemeanor. It says there's potential civil fines under 187A12.5, and here's what they are. But it doesn't say forfeiture. And under the law, that's where they should have put it, and that's where they're required to put it. 199-7 does not give them that authority for the reasons the court has already stated. As Chief Justice Moon pointed out, is it a reasonable interpretation of these rules and statutes for a person to know that if I violate these administrative rules, which constitutes a petty misdemeanor, that I'm going to have my property forfeited? Clearly, no. Yes?
So what specific language is the prosecution saying constitutes under 712 specifically authorized forfeiture?
It's that circuitous bootstrapping argument that I made before, which
the language is any equipment, article, etc.
Yes.
Instrument, aircraft, vehicle, or vessel.
Yes. And where their argument fails, Your Honor, is...
Isn't that specific?
It's not specific because it, again, applies to the scope and nature and of their authority for having police powers. As we have already pointed out through the course of the morning's discussion, there are other specific administrative rules and other specific statutes where forfeiture under 712A is specifically articulated as a consequence. In this particular case, 199 is not a covered offense. It's not something that my clients were charged with violating. If forfeiture was a consequence of violating these rules, and that were a proper interpretation of the law, then
170,
you...
I'm sorry, 177-9 doesn't set out an offense. Is that...
199-7,
I'm
Your
sorry,
Honor? Yeah.
99-7.
Yes, it does not set out a specific offense which you can charge...
712, I'm sorry, refers to offenses.
Right. Right, so 199-7 is not an offense for which somebody can be charged with violating. And that's why their argument fails. And unless the court has anything else, I'll rest on my argument in the briefs.
Thank you to both counsel.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Take this matter under advisement.
Be right. Oh, speak up, Thomas.